So we'll be in Genesis chapter 1 today and addressing really some of the big questions. We're going to talk about Genesis chapter 1, in particular a series called Before the Fall. There are many questions that have plagued humanity from the beginning of humanity, from the beginning of history, and all of humanity at the very beginning. And those questions today are probably questions that you've asked. I'm sure there are questions that someone has asked who you know. And it starts with questions like this. Why are we here? Why are we here? And also a question that might sound like this. How in the world did we get here? Third question that a lot of people ask and have been asking from the beginning of time is, how could there be so much suffering in the world? Where could it come from? How could that be true? And I think that there's a fourth question plaguing most of us in this area, which is this. When will Cicero Chick-fil-A officially break ground and open up? That's the real question. And while I was at the fair, I came up with another question that should be asked of everyone. I don't know if it is, but it should be, and that's this. When you get to the fair and you start walking in and amongst all that great food and all the food stands, who is it and why does anyone order Little Caesar's pizza at the fair? Who are these people? If it's you, let me invite you to repent, confess your sin, turn from your wicked ways, and embrace all of God's best food at the fair. Today, we're going to address a problem, and one of the problems that we're facing is this. If you don't pursue answers to life's big questions, and you don't settle on those answers and believe those answers, it leads to a life of chaos and confusion, disorientation. And for most people who don't have settled answers to those questions, their life is in turmoil the rest of their life. And I invite you today to open your own heart, open your own mind to the idea that all of those questions have been answered in the book of Genesis, specifically at the very beginning when God creates this paradise and says, it will be and it shall be like this. And all of this, God says, is good. It's very good. And then, of course, we see eventually comes the fall. We see sin, suffering, and everything that you and I experience now on a regular basis as it relates to humanity and life experiences on earth. But when we look before the fall, we see who God is. We are able to discover the character and nature of God. Starting with this, today is week one of a four-week series called Before the Fall, and here's what we're going to talk about today. God is a God of order. God is a God of order. His character and his nature is revealed to us in this way. He is a God of order. So for the next 4 weeks, we're going to tackle what is very well could be, listen to this, what very well could be the most controversial part of the entire Bible. Here's why. It's not just controversial outside of the Christian faith. It is also controversial and hotly debated within the Christian circles. So today, we're going to close our eyes and dive into the controversy, okay? We are going to look at this debate and try to make our way through it a little bit, starting with Genesis chapter 1, verses 1 and 2. Now, keep in mind that Genesis, the word Genesis, we get that title from the Greek, and it means origins. It means beginning. It means very beginning origin. And from the Hebrew, the title of Genesis is actually called In the Beginning, taking the name of the book from the actual first three words of the book, In the Beginning. Let's read this together. It's Genesis chapter 1, verses 1 and 2. And it goes like this. Follow right along. In the beginning, God created. Let's say that again, and you finish my next word here. In the beginning, who? God. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. The earth was formless and empty, and darkness covered the deep waters, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the surface of the waters. Now, when we lean into a debate, especially a debate, it's not just a debate, but it's a hot debate, I want to offer some rules of engagement, because it's important. If you're going to be fighting, you fight fair, okay? When you debate, and this is something that I always long for, and that is that anytime my side of any argument is in a debate, I long for my side to fight humbly or to debate with respect. And here's the rules of engagement. Anytime you're involved in this back and forth over a particular Bible debate or a debate about the faith, here's what I want to ask you to consider. Approach all of this with deep humility. We believe these scripture texts were inspired by the Creator of the universe and offered to reveal Himself, offered to us to reveal Himself. And these texts are sacred and they're ancient, having been passed down from hundreds of century after century after century. So approach these texts with respect and humility. Now, what that means is you don't find something that you believe to be the truth and then weaponize the truth. The truth should not be a bludgeon that you beat your opponent with. The objective is not to win the argument. The objective is always to persuade someone. Is that not the objective? So we take the truth, we don't weaponize it, we simply offer it in humility and in truth. We trust that God is at work helping us to understand by His Spirit what the truth really is, but always, always, always choose to be both right, pursue being right, and also persuasive. Secondly, avoid hobby horse faith. This plagues so much of us in the Christian community. And hobby horse means that you get one angle on one topic, and you talk and think and evangelize that topic more than you do any other aspects of the scripture, and eventually it becomes elevated over the amount of time that you think and talk about the gospel, the precious work and person of Jesus. And it's so easy as we get to pet peeves surrounding whatever, politics or whatever our angle is. So be very careful not to make anything a hobby horse faith. Also, be very, very careful. This is one of the things that makes me crazy when I'm in some, when I'm reading about or following along in some kind of debate, or I'm involved in some kind of conversation and there's opposing sides. You know, one of the things that just absolutely makes me insane and I just want to quit and give up talking about it is this: when the other person formulates my argument for me and they choose the weakest, lamest argument that you could possibly come up with, and then they're like, and then they knock it over and they're like, see, you don't know what you're talking about. See, that's not even true. See, that's not real. See, that's lame. See how weak that is. And I always think to myself, that's not even my argument. I hear people on the TV all the time, whether they're talking about one side or other, and I always say, that's not even what I believe. I don't even think that. So you didn't accomplish anything. So here's what I'm saying. If you don't like when that happens to you, or let me say it this way, since I don't like when that happens to me, it's important in my own heart to always present the opposite side's best argument. If you think your argument can stand up against theirs, present their best argument. Work against their best argument. And do your best to research the other side, have a working knowledge of that argument so that you have an actual intelligible conversation. By the way, I think it's way overdue for more Christians to start saying things like, I don't really understand that topic very well. I haven't researched it. I'm not really an expert in that, so I don't really have an opinion. Can you imagine what would happen if a lot of us who ought to just started to say to people at work and in our classes and so on, I don't have an opinion on that. I don't know enough about it to actually say anything about it. Now, that being said, we're going to get the irony of this. Now we're going to talk about the Genesis creation account, in which I'm not an expert. So I'm going to put that out there for you. And by that, I mean I'm going to show you the four creationists, theories, or the four categories of creationist explanation, okay? So walk with me, if you would. This is not cut and dry. Creation, the account of creation is not cut and dry, even though I'm sure that a lot of you learned it on flannel graph, and there were little flannel pictures of God creating whatever. It's not as cut and dry as you and I may have thought, but here's, can I give you four? Now, let me brace you for this. Today, we're going to go longer than we normally go. You're going to get more information given to you than I normally give to you, but my prayer is that God brings it to life and it's nourishing to you, starting with what are the four interpretations of Genesis chapter 1? Let me give you four categories. Number one, the young earth creationism. That means, for those of us who have traditional fundamental Christianity, we believe that perspective believes that the earth is young, it's only a few thousand years old, and every day is a literal day that God used to create. There are 6 days of creation, 24-hour periods, and there is a nighttime in which it ends each day and starts the morning, and that God is more than capable in his omnipotence to create everything that we see and don't see in 6 days. And people who believe in the young earth creationism reference Exodus 20:11, which mentions the 6 days of creation. Also that Genesis is mostly a literal historical account of what actually happened. And people who believe the young earth creationism concept point to the fact that this is a book of history of things that literally happened. And other people say that in the young earth creationism believe that there are scientists, they know scientists, they reference scientists who are Christian, who adhere to, sign on, and promote the young earth creationism, okay? Now, there's another one. Now, would you believe, if you're a fundamental Christian, you come from a long tradition of Christian faith, would you believe not everybody believes that? There are good people, godly people, devoted people to the scriptures who believe in what's called an old earth creationism. That is, that there is a theory that the days are not actual days, but how many days does the scripture say could, how much time could one day be, according to scripture, 1,000 years? The idea here is that these days aren't literal, the nights aren't literal, that there are ages, that there's a gap theory, that there are major gaps in creation, and it's not a day at a time, it's an age at a time. Also, there are ways in which people point to science, that science provides evidence to suggest that the science actually uncovers the reality that the earth is old. And that, in fact, you can explain Genesis 1 this way, that literally, Genesis 1, according to the old earth creationists, they would say this, that Genesis 1 is a poem, that it is rhythm. That God said, God created, God did, God created, God said, and God routinely finished a passage by saying, he saw that it, the author would say, God saw what he made, and it is good. And in some cases, it was very good. And this pattern goes on, so much so that some who are in this camp would say, that's because Genesis 1 and 2 is kind of a poem, and then it moves on from there to provide historical narration. Also, morning and night, some would say here that morning and night are referenced before the sun and moon existed, lending itself to the idea that it's just a poem. Also, there's apparent contradictions. Specifically, there was vegetation before rain was possible, and that, in fact, while God is able to do that, in Genesis 2:5, the scriptures specifically say God didn't do that. He only made what could be sustained by the atmosphere, the sun, rain, and also be tilled by man. So literally, though God could do that, the scripture later references that God wouldn't do that and didn't do that. God is very able, but his power is confined, according to the old earth creationists, that God is able to create in one. Because that's, see, one of the things that young earth creationists will say is, God can do it. God could have done it in one day. God could create the universe 6 days and then rest, a figurative rest on the seventh day. Why? Because he's omnipotent. He has infinite power. But here's what the old earth creationists would say. They would say, God has the power, but he restrains his own power. My family every year goes to the fair and we pick up chicks. Me in particular. Here's what I mean. There's at the 4-H building, you know, there's little chickens and you can pick them up. That's so lame. That's such a dad joke. My kid's like, Dad, why? It's my family name. So we hold these little guys like this. And we don't really find ourselves at the 4-H building much anymore. My kids are kind of like, I don't really want to go there. And so, but when you go and you can pick up, I'm assuming you still can pick up chicks there. And here you're holding them. And you have the force, you have the power to snuff their little lives out, God forbid. I mean, I'll eat them in as long as they're in an eggshell. But I'm not going to eat them right out of my hand. You know what I'm talking about? So here's these little chicks. And we have the power to do what we want to the chick. But we don't. Here's what we do. We restrain our power to preserve life. And here's what old earth creationists say. They say that God has the power to do 6 days, but he chooses to do 6 ages. And let the gap of time elapse as he kind of paces himself. Okay, so there's one more thing. Also, scientists obviously point to all kinds of record, empirical data, and evidence that would suggest an old earth creation. Now, Third one, real quick, theistic evolution. That means that there is a God, and this idea is that God created, and then he steps back and does a laissez-faire hands-off. He's a deist. God is deistic. He just kind of starts, he sparks, initiates life, and then he steps back and lets it happen. Or some would even say that every evolutionary spark and mutation, God is miraculously involving himself to cause it. But for the most part, God is uninvolved with creation. There's a fourth one. Christians widely condemn this theory, and they widely resist the idea and call it a myth, and that is an atheistic evolution, that everything that's seen and experienced can be explained without any supernatural being involved at all. That everything that you see and experience, everything that we can study and research can be explained naturally, not supernaturally. And of course, the Christian community, the Bible community condemns that worldview. So what was the author's intent of Genesis? Why did the author write Genesis? There is some indication that there is evolutionists, atheists in ancient period of time in the ancient Near East, and that they had proposed this naturalism that we just talked about, this evolutionary atheism, and in particular, this particular philosopher, mathematician named Thales, and some would say that's why. But here's what we do know. We're not sure about that, but here's what we do know. Can I tell you what we know? We know for sure that Genesis was written to start the story of history and humanity with God. In the beginning, what? God. And we're going to see later on that in the passage of Genesis chapter 1, you see God, 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 God. It is littered and loaded with the person of God who is at work. So it's to start our story with God, also to reveal some things about the nature of God, not only that there is a God, but what is he like, and also to lay out for us an account of who we are, to help us account for and explain where we came from. And in the weeks to come, we're going to look at, before the fall, we'll look at things like our purpose. And it's all explained here in Genesis before the fall. And potentially to be a counter-creation account to the ancient Near East myths that were prevalent in Babylon. Now, I'm going to do something that no public speaker ought to do. And that is, I'm going to read you two things side by side and try to help you compare that. Not the comparison part, but it's very difficult to read something and have you all stay with me. How many of you would vow, Pastor, no matter how bad you read, I'm following along? Would you raise your hand? I want to see who you are. Now, if you didn't raise your hand, we have video of the service. We know every single one of you who did not raise your hand in rebellion. Would you do your best? Stay engaged to the story. Because here's what I'll read you. The Babylonians perpetuated a myth that would explain creation that they passed on from generation to generation. And I want you to hear it. And I'm going to do my best reading because I want to present a strong argument on their side for why this myth could explain creation. So I'm not going to read it all lame-brained. I'm going to read it super sharp. Listen, here we go. This is called Enuma Elish. It is a creation theory. It's a myth that's been passed down from generation to generation in Babylon, in the ancient Near East. And here's how it goes. See if you recognize the first three words. In the beginning. By the way, you have it in your notes on the back couple pages there. You'll see it. Or you can lazily follow along right here behind me on the screen. Here we go. In the beginning, there was water swirling in chaos. Out of the swirl, the waters divided into sweet, fresh water, known as the god Apsu, and salty, bitter water, the goddess Tiamat. Once differentiated, the union of these two entities gave birth to the younger gods. These young gods, however, were extremely loud, must be teenagers, troubling the sleep of Apsu at night and distracting him from his work during the day. Upon the advice of his vizier, Mumu, Apsu decides to kill the younger gods. Tiamat, hearing of their plan, warns her eldest son, Enki, and puts Apsu to sleep and kills him. From Apsu's remains, Enki creates his home. Tiamat, once the supporter of the younger gods, now is enraged that they have killed her mate. She consults with the god Quingu, who advises her to make war on the younger gods. With Quingu as her champion, Tiamat summons the forces of chaos and creates 11 horrible monsters to destroy her children. Enki and the younger gods fight against Tiamat futilely until from among them emerges the champion Marduk, who swears he will defeat Tiamat. Marduk first defeats Quingu and then kills Tiamat by shooting her with an arrow which splits her in two. It's going to get gory. From her eyes now flow the waters of the Tigris and Euphrates rivers. Out of Tiamat's corpse, Marduk creates the heavens and the earth. He appoints gods to various duties and blinds Tiamat's 11 creatures to his feet, binds them to his feet as trophies before setting their images in his new home. After the gods have finished praising him for his great victory and the art of his creation, Marduk consults with the god Ea, the god of wisdom, and he decides to create human beings from the remains of whichever of the gods instigated Tiamat to war. Quingu is charged as guilty and killed, and from his blood, Ea creates Lelu, the first man to be a helper to the gods in their eternal task of maintaining order and keeping chaos at bay. Following this, Marduk arranged the organization of the netherworld and distributed the gods to their appointed stations. Then the poem ends with some more summary. So, did you catch that? Anybody able to follow along with that? Let me sum it up for you. Chaos, vengeance, violence. Right? Vengeance, chaos, and violence. Now, with that in mind, with that as kind of the background, I want you to compare that. By the way, in our culture, the myth, according to humanists and naturalists and those who consider themselves atheists, and even secularists, the myth about creation is Genesis chapter 1. In their minds, the other side says, no, it is the Christian view that is the myth. Now, I want to kind of put this side by side. So can you stay with me now listen to this. If you stick with me during the Babylonian myth, God forbid any of us lose track reading Genesis chapter 1, right? Here we go, Genesis chapter 1. Follow along with me. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. The earth was formless and empty, and darkness covered the deep waters. And the Spirit of God was hovering over the surface of the waters. Then God said, "Let there be light," and there was light. And God saw that the light was good. Then he separated the light from the darkness. God called the light day and the darkness night. And everything passed, and morning came, marking the first day. Then God said, "Let there be a space between the waters to separate the waters of the heavens from the waters of the earth." And that is what happened. God made this space to separate the waters of the earth from the waters of the heavens. God called the space sky. And evening passed, and morning came, marking the second day. Then God said, "Let the waters beneath the sky flow together in one place, so dry ground may appear." And that's what happened. God called the dry ground land, and the waters seas. And God saw that it was good. Then God said, "Let the land sprout with vegetation, every sort of seed-bearing plant and trees that grow seed-bearing fruit. These seeds will then produce the kinds of plants and trees from which they came." And that is what happened. The land produced vegetation, all sorts of seed-bearing plants and trees with seed-bearing fruit. Their seeds produced plants and trees of the same kind, and God saw that it was good. And evening passed, and morning came, marking the third day. Then God said, "Let lights appear in the sky to separate the day from the night. Let them mark off the seasons, days, and years. Let these lights in the sky shine down on the earth." And that is what happened. God made two great lights, the larger one to govern the day and the smaller one to govern the night. He also made the stars. God set these lights in the sky to light the earth, to govern the day and night, and to separate the light from the darkness. And God saw that it was good. And evening passed and morning came, marking the fourth day. Then God said, "Let the waters swarm with fish and other life. Let the skies be filled with birds of every kind." So God created great sea creatures, and every little thing that scurries and swarms in the water, and every sort of bird, each producing offspring of the same kind. And God saw that it was good. Then he blessed them, saying, "Be fruitful and multiply. Let the fish fill the seas, and let the birds multiply on the earth." And evening passed, and morning came, marking the fifth day. Then God said, "Let the earth produce every sort of animal, each producing offspring of the same kind. Livestock, small animals, that scurry along the ground." How many of you could have done without the scurrying things? Creepy, crawly things. Anybody else? And it was not good. Each able to produce offspring of the same kind, and God saw that it was good. Then God said, "Let us make human beings in our image to be like us. They will reign over the fish in the sea, the birds in the sky, the livestock, all the wild animals on the earth, and small animals that scurry along the ground. So God created human beings in his own image. In the image of God, he created them. Male and female, he created them. Then God blessed them and said, be fruitful and multiply, fill the earth and govern it, reign over the fish in the sea and the birds in the sky and all the animals that scurry along the ground. Then God said, look, I have given you every seed-bearing plant throughout the earth and all the fruit trees for your food. And I have given you every green plant as food for all the wild animals, the birds in the sky and the small animals that scurry along the ground, everything that has life, and that is what happened. Then God looked over all he had made, and he saw that it was very good, and evening passed, and morning came, marking the sixth day. Now compare that to the myth of the chaos and the violence and the revenge and the upheaval in the Babylonian myth that was considered and passed on from generation to generation a realistic, historical, credible explanation for how we all got here. Now, if you compare the two, here's what you're going to notice. I tried to highlight this in the passage in your notes. I tried to highlight that it is littered and loaded with phrases that go like this. God said, God did, God created, God did, God created. On and on and on. Who do we see at the center, supremely affixed in the middle of all creation? Sovereignly at work, we see the Creator God at work. So, here's the question. What do we learn from this? So I have a little bit of time left, and I want you, if you don't mind, would you kind of come along and see, what do we learn by this? What do we learn? What does this teach us and tell us? What's the sense of rehashing the creation account? Here's what it does. We learn from this creation account something about God that helps us to see him, and when you see God, the Spirit helps us treasure God, and when we look closely at this, here's what we see. We see that God is in control. God's not in a tug-of-war battle with Satan and all his demons. God's not pulling back and forth on humanity. God's not consulting humanity and asking them for their advice. There is one source, there is one power. It never changes hands in Genesis chapter 1. Imagine God is more like an artist standing before a canvas, and he's effortlessly and easily and naturally creating on a blank canvas. God is not under duress. He is always here in this account proactive, never reacting. He simply speaks. He doesn't seek counsel or advice. He speaks, and everything that is came to be. There's no extra energy. There's no wasted effort. He doesn't take a lunch break or a coffee break. Thank God he doesn't take a cigarette break. He doesn't take any breaks. He doesn't. He is effortlessly in control. Next, we also see that God is in unity. We see that God is in unity. God himself creates. In the beginning, God created. And then what else do we learn? We learn that the Spirit of God is where? Hovering over the face of the deep. What else do we learn? That the Son, later on in John chapter 1, you'll see John say, in the beginning was who? Was the Word, and the Word was where? With God. And what happened to the Word? The Word became flesh in the person of Jesus. Now, Jesus, by his own power, holds all things together. We have at the very beginning a Trinity who is in unity, interdependent. We have God who is, in essence, one single being in three persons who are interconnected, interdependent, are working together in perfect, flawless harmony, one with another, both to create the earth and the world and the universe, but also to sustain it. Now God the Father is ruling and reigning over all things. Jesus stands at the right hand of the Father, pleading and interceding for believers, and also the Spirit of God is at work, comforting, counseling, and helping us to see and savor who Jesus is, to come to faith and repentance and grow in faith. The Spirit's at work doing that. All three in unity doing that together. Number three, here's what else we see. We see that God is orderly. That God is orderly. In his character, in his nature, God expresses that you can count on the fact that he is an orderly God. The intentionality. You know, one of the things that blows my mind, every time I try to remember this, when I eat something that has a seed, I try to pay attention to the seed and say, that is fascinating. you pick some fruit, and in the fruit is a seed, and when that seed goes into the ground and dies, it bears more fruit. And it just perpetuates itself. It's miraculous, and God has intentionally done that. God has, how many of you, your parents told you that you can't eat the seeds because a tree will grow in your stomach? Anybody get told that lie? Parents, I'm sorry to expose that lie publicly, but how many kids thought for a while, uh-oh, these branches, one of the branches is gonna kinda come out. God did things in order. It was intentional. Listen, it was thoughtful. It was in stark contrast to the randomness, the violence, and the chaos of the ancient Near Eastern myths. Or, by the way, of the myths, when you go on and try to read people describing how we all came to be and what our purpose is, and you just read it in the news or bloggers or books, and you go, total chaos. How could I possibly understand all of those things? How could that make sense of anything? And God has created space. In his orderly character, he made space, light, heavens, earth, vegetation. In the first 3 days, he made space. In the next 3 days, he actually filled that space with vegetation. He filled it with the sun and the moon. He filled it with people and animals after orderly creating it. Now, you've got another part of your notes there with a box. Would you turn over to where there's a part, there's a box in your notes, and it says at the beginning, at the top of it, it says believe. Believe. Here's what I want you to see, because this is so important. That God is a God of order. And keep this in mind. Let me say one more thing about a God being a God who is orderly. Can I say one more thing before you get to that box? Listen to this. One of the ideas behind God's orderliness actually is difficult for atheists. Again, I'm not an expert in this position. I don't fully understand how atheists see this, but I've read a bit about how one of the naturalist, secularist, humanistic, atheistic evolution worldview really struggles to define is the concept of mathematics. And here's why. Because mathematics wasn't something created. Mathematics was something discovered. And it indicates that there was a mind, an intelligent designer behind creating math. And by the way, if you get into music, here's what you learn about music. Blows my mind. Music is mathematical. Or is it mathematic? It's mathematically inclined. Music and math go together. And no matter what you think about God and how he came to be and what kind of God he is, here's the idea. Math and music exist to be discovered and learned by we humans, and the implication is this, that there is an intelligent, brilliant, intelligent mind behind creation. And it's very, very complicated to try to say, well, no, that is just random. How many of you have learned over time, math isn't random. It can't be made random. It is specifically what it is. So what should we do? What does this mean? If you believe this, if you believe that God is in control, if you believe that God is in unity, and if you believe, in fact, that God is orderly, do you know what it does? It kind of boosts your ability to trust God. It helps you trust. It gives you a shot of, like a shot of steroid to enhance your trust for a God that we believe in. It is a life-changing boost to your trust. And here's how I want you to fill that blank in. The God who ordered the universe, the God who ordered the universe, the one in charge, the one who ordered the whole thing, he is always and forever ordering your steps. Always and forever. That same God is always and forever at work ordering your steps. And of course, the implications of this are intense. That God expects, when he's at work in our lives, he expects to put our lives in order, our homes in order, our hearts in order. He expects to be putting our marriages in order, our families in order, our coworkers, our work and career in order. When God's at work, he puts things in order. By the way, how many planners do I have in here? Anybody a planner just by nature? Raise your hand. You didn't plan to raise your hand, but just spontaneously raise your hand. Where are you? Planners. I've got some painful news for you. Painful news. For those of us who are more on the spontaneous side, we actually find ourselves to be a little bit more sacred in this area. Here's what the scriptures teach in Proverbs. Proverbs says, we make our plans. We have ideas. We order our own steps, but in reality, it is God himself who orders our steps. Or let me put it another way in Proverbs. The Lord directs our steps, so why try to understand everything along the way? Here's what the author is saying. God is a God who's in control. God is a God who is in unity, who's always at work, and God is a God of order. So just take the next steps that God is bringing to your life. We can't figure it all out. We just trust that God's at work, and he's ordering these things for us and to us. Okay, one more thing about order. Now, there is an idea in some factions of the Christian faith, some tribes. There are parts of the Christian tribe that believe what I believe to be, based on what we learn about God, a myth. Some people believe it so extremely that it would go all the way to the extent of being considered a lie. And that is this: that it is more spiritual to be spontaneous. That God, somehow, in his spontaneity, is expressing spirituality. In other words, they say this: if the more spontaneous it is, the more spiritual it is. Believe me when I tell you, you ought to be thankful to God that I don't believe that and walk up here every Sunday and say, here we go, we're going to be spiritual all over these people. Now, if that happens one day where I decide, okay, we're going to try to be more spiritual by being more spontaneous, I'm going to give you a warning. You decide if you want to be here on that Sunday or for that series. But I can tell you this: the Spirit, based on what we see here in the character of God, God is supreme planner. He is infinitely strategic. And he knows everything and every step along the way. By the way, how else could we explain all the insane amount of detail in the Old Testament laws and in the tabernacles and temples that were built? And God puts an infinite amount of order and detail into those things, unless we were to fully believe and fully trust that God does, God is infinitely strategic. And also, keep in mind, Paul picks up on this later on in 1 Corinthians. He's trying to help the church at Corinth deal with their response to the work of the Spirit. And here's what he keeps telling them. He says over and over, everything that happens, if God is in the middle of it and causing it, it is going to be decent and in what? In order. Because God is a God of order. Okay, number four, we see here in this Genesis chapter 1 account that God is actually in humanity. God is in humanity. God said, let us make man in our image, for after our likeness, and we bear the image, or we reflect and look like God, the Father, the Son, and the Spirit. That means that by bearing the image of God, he has given us what we need to express our will, to have emotions, to have a mind, to be able to love, to give and receive love, to need love. And what about the overall discernment between right and wrong, the ability to create, to enjoy with our senses all the things that God has created? What does that mean? It means God has kind of planted his image in us and on us. He's made us like himself in that way. And that's why we have our image and worth. Our value is something that God has declared over us. It's not something determined by our experiences, what someone else said about us, or what you think about yourself. Our image is one that has been given to us from the Creator of the universe and has been implanted once and for all into every human being. Every human being. And that's why this makes this things that's going on in Charlottesville, that went on in Charlottesville, so absolutely unacceptable to anybody who is a Bible-believing Christian and believes in the character and nature of God. And that's this: no matter who you oppose, no matter how intensely you don't like what they are saying, every single person who trusts and believes that there is a God who is in humanity and has created us in his image, has to at least yield to the idea that the person that you don't agree with is just like you, is made in the image of God. How would it melt people's minds if they ever learned and discovered in reality that the person that they're throwing stones at is exactly like them? They have different cultures, they have different convictions, they have different skin color, they have different, however it happened, by nurture or nature, God created us all the same. We bear his image. And that's one thing universally that all human beings, no matter how you, that's why as Christians, we should be condemning any form of disrespecting or dishonoring any other human being, no matter what they say, no matter what they do, and no matter where they come from. Especially no matter what skin. I love the idea that red and yellow, black and white, God has created us all in his image, and we share that, and it holds us together deeply, even if you're not a person of faith. By the way, never forget what we saw in Charlottesville. And this, I mean, wouldn't you admit, Charlottesville is just a flare-up point, right? The roots of this are dark and wicked, right? But in bearing the image of God, we don't do a very good job. We're not very good at it, but there is one who does it perfectly. God created, I should say, more accurately, God sent his son, and his son came, and here's what he did. He represented, he reflected, he bore the image of the Father perfectly. He is the express perfect image of the infinite creator who came in the flesh, and we could see and experience God because Jesus is the perfect image bearer and works and continues to work to bring us back into relationship with the three in one who are recreating us into the image of God. By the way, if you're growing in your faith, you're being created into the image of God, into Christ-likeness. So how should we respond to this? Will you give me a few more minutes before you grab your keys and start shaking them at me like my dad used to do to the preacher? Jingle, jingle, jingle. I know what your watch says, but I know what the Spirit's doing, but my keys. How should we respond to a God who is all of these things? How should we respond? If you behold and see God the way that I've described him, if you believe and trust God to be all that he is, then God expects that you and I would take a step of obedience, that we would obey God, that we don't just see him and treasure him and trust him, but we also obey him in obedient response because of all that he is. And if that's the case, then I want to see if I could convince you or at least persuade you or at least challenge you to do this. Turn back to God for all of the stability that you need and want in your life. Turn back to God for the harmony that you want, for the peace that you need, and for the personal worth and value and significance that you desire. You have to turn away from the people and away from the things that you have turned to receive all of those things. And I want to invite you to turn back to the only one who can provide them perfectly for you, who has made you to find all of these things in the Creator himself, the three in one. Turn back to God. Reject and renounce everything that you've turned to find stability and harmony and peace. You know what that means? For some of us, that's scary, because as our life spirals out of control, there's a lot of us who are control freaks, and we try to get control of it. But this is what I've learned. To the degree in which you take control of everything that you shouldn't have control of, you express a lack of trust in the one who controls all things. And I invite you to let it go. Let go of control of the circumstances, the people. Stop trying to control everyone and everything and express your trust that God is in charge. He's working for my good and for his glory. And some of you might have division in your life. There's factions that are kind of clashing, and you've got some confusion and division in your own personal life. Never forget, we serve a God who is in unity. And when you want to be a part of what God's doing, listen, if you want to join God in what he's doing, everywhere you are, bring unity. Help unity happen. Be a part of bringing unity to your marriage, unity to your family, unity to your home, unity to your workplace, your team, your classes, because God is always at work bringing unity. I also wonder if there's some of you, I assume there is, some of you who are sick of the chronic chaos in your life. Only God can bring order. Only God. Only God can straighten things out. Only God can bring the peace that you need to guard your heart and guard your mind from the chaos. And I know this, that if you want to get in tune and in touch with that kind of peace, it's probably true that you're going to have to purge the clutter in your life and spend more time in quiet places, absorbing and enjoying the peace that God brings quietly through his Spirit. Here's what I've learned over time. There's not a lot of peace available to me on my device. The more time, I'm not condemning devices. I actually find them a helpful tool, much like money and bricks and everything else. You can use them for, they're used in all different ways, but I haven't found a lot of peace there. My peace is in quietness, stillness, and God, when he wants to revive me, he tends to do so in quiet places, doing quiet things in peaceful places. It's time to declutter. Declutter. Because God is a God of peace and harmony. Lastly, I wonder if, I mean, this is true for probably plenty of people, that you've lost your sense of self, or sense of self-worth. You look in the mirror and you loathe. You don't just dislike. You're just not like the rest of us who are kind of like, eh, wish I was taller. Sorry, did I say that out loud? I'm so. I should be happy with being 6'2". But if you look in the mirror and you loathe what you see, here's what I want to invite you to do. God made you in his image. You don't just have the breath that is given to every mankind to bring life. He has put his breath in you. His breath is in you. He has sealed you and marked you, and he has determined and declared once and for all that you are in every way a reflection of God's nature and character and personhood. And our value, your value, comes when you cling to your identity that has been declared of you and declared over you. He gave you his breath. You are able, you have the power now to take off the old identity, to take on the new identity, and to wear it once and for all, and to enjoy it. God's in control. He's in unity. God is a God of order. He's in all of humanity. And we get to see it, treasure it, trust him, and respond in obedience. One of the responses that Jesus gave us was to break bread regularly to remember the Father, or remember the broken body of the Son and the shed blood. And our ushers are coming now to pass out the elements of remembrance today. And for the next few minutes, I mentioned to you that we'll go a little longer than usual today, but for the next few minutes, we'll take the time, take our time to remember. The ushers are going to be passing along two symbols. If you know what the symbols are, you believe what they represent, you have saving faith in the work of God through Jesus, then I invite you to join us as a part of his church, universal, around the world. If you don't quite know what it is, you're not quite familiar with the gospel, don't exactly know where you are in terms of your faith in Jesus, can I ask you to do something? Just let it pass by. I want you to be able to enjoy when it's time, when your heart has come to life with faith in Jesus, then you join in and you share it with his church. And we're careful to do that. Let's sing. We're going to sing.